This is Sefer Shmos, and this is number no less than 14. Maybe I'm missing 13, but this is no more than 14. It's no more than 14. Huh? Yeah, 13. Okay. Let's see where we got up to. Oh, we were in the middle of the end of Parshas Bo. Chapter 13 in Exodus. And the difficulty that we were addressing is this. Chapter 13 breaks up into two paragraphs. First paragraph is the first 10 psukim, 10 verses, which start with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's command to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses, sanctify me, the firstborn of all the children of Israel. And then he goes off onto a disquisition on all sorts of different subjects, having nothing to do with the firstborn. And there's the end of the paragraph, which in the Hebrew text really is the end of a paragraph. And then you come to the next, starting with Pasuk Yud Aleph, with verse 11. And suddenly all the laws of sanctifying the firstborn are mentioned. Which is what happened in between. So, in the last year, I explained to you that the basic theme, though we'll talk in more detail about the first paragraph today, Mitzvah Hashem, the basic theme of the first paragraph is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running the world. He took us out of Egypt, not because of any merit on our part, but because he wanted it to happen that way. Nature is an illusion. The so-called laws of nature are an illusion. We're talking about that in the 430 share, in more detail, about Destus Neis Vateva. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running the world solely. Now, this is background for the idea of sacrifices in general. Because in the ancient world, sacrifices were understood as economic. The gods have something we want, and we have something the gods want. They have rain and victory in war and fertility and health. And we have steaks and good wine and other sorts of things, which for some reason or other they want. So. Are you asking, or
no,
are you?
I know. Where's Rabbi Gottlieb?
He's sitting right here. I'm Rabbi Gottlieb.
Are you Rabbi Gottlieb?
Yeah. Last time I checked. Well, shall I check my identity papers in my pocket?
I can
perfectly all right. They're perfectly all right.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Have a seat, or take a, or do whatever else is on your mind. For the other nations of the world, the background of sacrifices was economic. We have something the gods want. The gods have something we want. We give them what they want. They give us what we want. That's utterly impossible from a Jewish point of view. Can't be that we're giving God steaks, which he can't get otherwise. There are many verses in the Tanakh where God says, you know, what will you give me? All the beasts of the field belong to me. He creates the whole universe. He said, but I have some great wine. Like, it's absurd. So the purpose of sacrifices has to be something entirely different. In general, the purpose of sacrifices is recognition. Not manipulating God to get something out of him that you can't get otherwise. As I pointed out last time, there's nowhere in the entire Tanakh where God promises, if you offer me sacrifices, I'll do this for you. Never you have that. You have promises based on keeping the commandments, but not on the basis of giving sacrifices. Sacrifices are designed to be recognition of certain truths or as expressions of a human feeling, attitude, change, realization, which then could generate changes in the way the person is dealt with, like when he's doing tshuva for mistakes that he's done. But the mere presentation of an item that God would appreciate is, from our point of view, absolutely impossible. And there's an interesting symptom of this. You should know that everywhere in the Tanakh, when something's mentioned the first time, it is mentioned in such a way as to reveal its essence, its fundamental nature. Where are sacrifices mentioned the first time?
Cain and Hevel.
Cain and Abel. And there it says, they both brought sacrifices to God, and it says, God turned to and accepted Hevel and his sacrifice, and to Cain and his sacrifice he didn't turn. It puts the person first and the sacrifice second. Now, according to the picture of the other nations, it's backwards. The picture of the other nations is this. The gods are looking down at Joe. Let's see. What should we do for Joe? Should we do anything for Joe? Let's see. He's presenting a sacrifice. Well, let's see what kind of sacrifice he presents. Wow. A fatted 3-year-old calf, just the best of everything. And a wine, 1936 Beaujolais from the north side of the vineyard. The very tops. Give him rain. Give him fertility. Give him. Another one comes. Look at that scrawny animal. Bah. That's terrible. And look over there in his corral. He has much better animals. No rain for him. Their picture is you evaluate the sacrifice, and on that basis you decide how to treat the person. Then, in the case of Cain and Hevel, to put the person first and the sacrifice second makes no sense. It should have said, God turned to Hevel's sacrifice. As a result of that, he turned to Hevel. But it doesn't say that. It says he turned to Hevel and his sacrifice. We see the sacrifice as part of an ongoing relationship with a past, present, and future. And the sacrifice expresses something in that relationship, and that's why it's significant. Sacrifice expresses something else, not that the sacrifice in and of itself, because it's good meat or bad meat, makes the difference. Now, here we're talking about firstborn. What's the idea of firstborn? You must have seen in your travels and in your experiences, you go into a restaurant, let's say, and next to the cashier, you'll see on the wall a framed $10 bill. Well, it used to be $10 bill, nowadays it's a $50 bill. Why is the owner of the restaurant framing a piece of good money and putting it up? Because that's the first $50 bill that the restaurant earned. So what? The answer is he invested money, time, and effort to create something that will make money. And this is the first money that it made. This shows it's operating, it's successful, it's functioning. That's why he puts it up. It's a symbol of the fact that it's operational. I think that's close to the idea here. You have a new animal, a female animal, and the animal grows. One of the things you want female animals for is to make more animals. The first animal the female has, that shows that this female animal is healthy and she will produce more for your flock. So you take that first one and say, Ribono Shel Olam, I recognize that the animal itself is a gift to me and the productive capacity is a gift for me, and that being the case, I'm offering it to you as a sacrifice. I'm offering the sacrifice in recognition of something already done. I'm not doing it to manipulate a new gift, but it's a recognition of something already done. That's why there's this introduction that you can't give God anything. You can't provide him with something that he needs by offering a sacrifice. It has to be understood differently. Are you with me? Okay, now let's look a little more detail at this first paragraph.
It also ends saying that it's mine. Says,
Okay, so now let's go back to 361. In a way, that first sentence contains what could be regarded as a contradiction. Sanctify to me every firstborn, first issue of every womb among the children of Israel, of man and beast, is mine. So now, how exactly does it work? Am I sanctifying it? Usually, when you sanctify something, you take something that isn't God's in a halachic sense. It's mine. Belongs to me. And I take an animal from my corral and I say, let this be a sacrifice. Then it changes the character entirely. It becomes holy. All sorts of restrictions that are applied to it. Because I said, let it be a sacrifice. If I hadn't said that, then I can plow with it. I can milk it. I can cut its wool, and I can slaughter it and eat it. So you say to me, sanctify the firstborn. That sounds like the firstborn has no special status, and I have a mitzvah to sanctify it. Then you tell me, it is mine. As a matter of fact, it is mine. Now the halacha is here. The halacha is that you don't have to do anything. The first one that's born has a sanctity. Whether you recognize it or don't recognize it, you declare it or you don't declare it, it has it automatically, just from the fact that it's the firstborn. Then you have a mitzvah to treat it with that sanctity. Or to go through a statement that recognizes its sanctity, but you are not creating its sanctity. But that is quite true, that it is that way in and of itself. How it got that way will be addressed in the second paragraph. Okay, now I want to skip down in this paragraph to what we talked about chametz last time at matzah, to verse 9. We're told to celebrate Passover and not to eat chametz and to eat matzah and to remember the Exodus from Egypt. And it shall be for you a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes, so that Hashem's Torah will be in your mouth. So that is really in the Hebrew. For with a strong hand Hashem removed you from Egypt. When you hear, it shall be a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes. What do you associate those words with?
Tefillin.
The mitzvah of tefillin. Phylacteries. And indeed, this is one of the paragraphs that's written in the tefillin that you put on your arm and on your head. One of the commentators, the Rashbam, says that these words have nothing to do with tefillin. They have nothing to do with tefillin. The Torah here is speaking poetically. When it says that it's a sign on your arm, it just means that all your actions should take account of the fact that God took you out of Egypt and you owe Him service. Reminder between your eyes means that you should think about it. You should be conscious of it. You should be mindful of it. Doesn't say anything about leather parchment or leather boxes or leather straps. It's not talking about that. The mitzvah is tefillin. We have an oral tradition. Moses commanded us from God. The mitzvah is 100% the mitzvah. There's no way to avoid it. These verses aren't talking about that. Now, if you look very carefully at this verse, I think you can find that the Rashbam's pshat is not 100% smooth. Look carefully at what's said there. You could raise a point of query concerning the Rashbam's pshat.
Yeah, it's the fact that it says ot al yadcha. It's a sign on your hand, and we know that tefillin is an ot, like Shabbat.
You know that because you take this verse to be talking about, and you say, because Chazal say so. Okay, but we're talking about Pshat now. In Pshat, that's what's called begging the question in logic.
Right.
Now, I'm just on the level of Pshat now. You can even get this in English. Again, the Rashbam says, it should be a sign on your hand. That's just poetry. What it means is, all your actions should be dedicated to God. Reminder between your eyes, that doesn't mean to put a leather box on your head. It means you should be always mindful of it. You have one verse, but don't leave out any material in the verse. You have a whole verse.
So Hashem's Torah may be in your mouth.
Yes. So Hashem's Torah shall be in your mouth. No, what are you going to do with that?
Seems to be saying that it's almost like specific. The man,
right,
is because of this, it will be because of whatever this sign and this doing, it should be for a sign. It should therefore tere the man tiyat teres Hashem v'deicha, which is it's obviously something. I don't see how it connects directly to what we're saying, but it's, like you said, it's obviously missing.
Good, that's right. The Torah says, let's. What's our problem now? When it says a sign on your arm and mind between your eyes, we don't know what that means. It could be leather boxes, or it could be what the Rashbam says. Let's make it blank for a minute. There are two things to do, A and B. Do A and do B in order that God's Torah be in your mouth. So A and B have to be means to God's Torah being in your mouth. Means, right? It wouldn't do if A and B already included God's Torah being in your mouth. Then it wouldn't be a means. It's got to be something else. You say, look, if you do A and B, that'll bring you to a situation in which God's Torah will be in your mouth.
So there's something to do. It's not just poetry.
Well, not quite. I mean, the Rashbam is also telling you something to do. Right? The poetry tells you what to do. But think of what it's telling you. It's telling you, according to the Rashbam, all your actions should be dedicated to God. And you should be constantly thinking and focused on God's words and the Exodus from Egypt so that the Torah should be in your mouth. Either the Torah being in your mouth is already included, or it's anticlimactic. If all your actions are dedicated and all your thoughts are dedicated, can't be that you dedicate all your actions and all your thoughts for the purpose of God's Torah being in your mouth. Whereas, if you think of it as leather boxes, then you have something. Put a leather box on your arm, put a leather box on your head. Remember, the mitzvah is to wear them all day. Not just for a half hour in the morning when you daven. The mitzvah is all day. And if you wear it during all the day, you can wear it into the night as well. You don't have to take them off at sunset. So men went around with these tefillin on all the time. Right? That will be a constant reminder. It's a physical reminder. And that will bring you to be speaking about Torah. That makes sense as a means to an end. Whereas if you think that it's poetry and it's telling you all your actions should be dedicated to God and all your thoughts should be dedicated to God, then speaking about Torah is either included or it's anticlimactic. It's not a worthy further accomplishment to what the means is. So the Rashbam doesn't... You could query the Rashbam on the basis that the in order to have God's Torah in your mouth doesn't fit as smoothly for the Rashbam. Yeah, we're together on the same thing.
I think that actions, all your actions and all your thoughts, is not necessarily Torah. It could be actually a reminder, because everywhere you walk, you're going to be thinking, oh, I've got to be thinking about just a triune God, that will lead you to Torah. It's not that right.
It's that question of leading you to Torah. It's that the Torah should be in your mouth.
While it'll be in your mouth, you'll be thinking about it. It'll be on your mind. Everything you do, oh, this is Torah.
But why is all your actions and all your thoughts less important than the Torah being in your mouth? When I say do A and B in order to accomplish C, what I'm saying is A and B are means to C. Right? Which sounds like C is more important. And I'm telling you to do A and B to get to C. Right? Right? So if it's already that all your actions are dedicated to God, and all your thoughts are dedicated to God, in order that you should be talking Torah, you know, the tail's wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the first two are external, you know, so Torah can be in your mouth.
That's right. That's right. If they're external, so that internally in your thought processes and your actions will be affected by the thing that you do externally. Right. Okay. Now, let's do the second paragraph, at least a couple of details in it. Shall come to pass when Hashem will bring into the land the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, give it to you, set apart the first issue of every womb to Hashem. Every first issue is dropped by livestock belonging to you, the males are Hashem's. Okay, then, the donkey. And it shall be, when your son will ask you at some future time, what is this? You shall say to him, with a strong hand, Hashem removed us from Egypt, from the house of bondage. It's always over and over again, strong hand. I explained to you last time. Strong hand means it has to overcome opposition. Strength is only relevant when you're overcoming opposition. What kind of opposition could God face that it had to be told that it's a strong hand? What kind of opposition would be relevant to God? The answer is, it's got to be internal opposition. Nothing external to God can be opposed to God to require God to use strength. What? The Egyptian army? You know, or the daytime and nighttime? He's the creator of the universe. But what? God is committed to various principles and values in running the world. And since the Jews don't deserve to be saved, God has to override his own principle of justice in order to save them. That's a strong hand. Now, 15. It happened when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to send us out, that Hashem killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of man to the firstborn of beast. Therefore, says in the Torah, I offer to Hashem all male first issue of the womb, redeem the firstborn of my sons. The question is, what's the there for? Okay, God destroyed all of the Egyptian firstborn. That's correct. Yes, he did. So what? So he did that. What has it got to do with us? Why then are we, why is it natural, appropriate, fitting? Now you see. Maharal here says something very interesting. He says, everything that exists in this world has its root in a higher reality, in a spiritual reality. That's true for every detail in this world, and it's true for all the categories in this world. When God killed all of the firstborn in the land of Egypt, men, the people, animals, how did he do it? Did he do it by picking out each of the individuals, or did he have a more abstract interaction with the root of firstbornness, so to speak? Says the Maharal, it was a much higher impact, much higher incident. It wasn't the individuals. It was that the root of being firstborn had a certain effect. And therefore, the effect wasn't limited to the Egyptians. It had a simultaneous effect on the Egyptians and on us. And this is carried out. It's mentioned several times later on in the Torah. That the two go hand in hand. Now, you can, if you want, push it in a fairly simple fashion. Did our firstborn deserve to be saved? Were we so extravagantly different from the Egyptians that we deserved to be saved? Maybe not. If not, then you say, well, then something special had to be done to save them. And in saving them, God then acquires them. Now we're back to what you said at the beginning. Lihu, they belong to me. They belong to me because of the history. You are now commanded to treat them in a special way, but they belong to me because I saved them. A similar thing is said with respect to God's relationship to the Jewish people as a whole. God says, I took you out of Egypt in order to be your God, in order that you should receive the Torah and keep the commandments. Because you were slaves, and I took you out, you owe me service. If it weren't for me, you'd be slaves to the Egyptians. And therefore, you owe me this service. So, in a similar way to saying, you owe me service because I took you out of slavery, similarly, he says, the firstborn are mine because your firstborn should have been killed also. And I saved them. Because I saved them from death, they belong to me. It's a similar process, yeah.
Why, first of all, why are we only saying the firstborn? Everybody. It should be everybody.
Well, the decree of death, against the Egyptians was only for the firstborn. So
slavery.
Save...
Slavery. Taking out of slavery.
It does apply to everybody.
It says that.
Yes, Bnei Yisrael. You could ask about the Levim, but I'm even leaving that aside. Yeah, what's the other thing?
I just noticed we're talking about for Ha'ilacha, Ha'is Ha'ilacha, was Yifra Menenecha. So here it says, Utai Tafas.
Oh, okay, I'm coming to that now. Here you have two expressions of the mitzvah of tefillin. In the first paragraph it ends, it says about tefillin, there should be a zikaron, a reminder between your eyes, an os on your hand, which is a sign, and a reminder between your eyes. Let's clear up one thing. Between your eyes. Who puts tefillin between their eyes? The Karaites. The Tzedokim. They put the tefillin here. Between the eyes. Right? What are we going to say about that? Between the eyes. So guess what? There's another verse elsewhere which says there were non-Jews who, as part of their idolatrous practices, used to shave their heads and make bald spots. And the Torah says, don't make a bald spot between your eyes. Look around the room. You'll see that for the vast majority of people, The spot between your eyes is naturally bald. There's nothing there. What does it mean? It means, like, you know, the Apaches left the hair in the center. It means shaving off the hair in the center. Between here, back to eighth grade geometry, between here means equidistant from your eyes. And that's where we put it. This spot on your head is equidistant. A line down to your eye and line down to the side are the same length. They're equidistant from the eyes. Just like it says about not making a bald spot. So much for the carrots. Now, notice here that it says, "V'haya l'chalaos." It'll be for you a sign. Think back. Where did we have that phraseology, and we learned something important from it? I think you were the only person who was there. When they slaughtered the Paschal sacrifice, where did they put the blood?
On the doorpost.
Where on the doorpost?
Where the mezuzah goes.
Yeah, where on the doorpost where the mezuzah goes?
I don't know, it's outside
inside. Okay, the inside of the doorway? Or the door or the outside of the door?
It's on the outside.
As a matter of fact, it's on the inside.
Oh,
and
really?
It says, V'hoy ha'dam lechem lo'os. And Rashi says, therefore, it's on the inside. And when it's there, the God will see it. Oh, the commentator says, God, so looking, I wonder if this Jewish house isn't a Jewish house. Oh, I see the blood on the doorway. It's a Jewish house. I'm going out to... It's ridiculous. God doesn't have to look at the blood to see whether it's a Jewish house or not. What he sees is that you're doing his mitzvah of putting up the blood.
Oh, doesn't it mean,
it's on the inside. It's on the inside. Lachem, it's a sign for you means you've got to see it. Can't be outside the door. Then you can't see. It's not a sign for you. So you're putting it up inside, and he sees the fact that you're doing his mitzvah. So here's the idea that the arm tefillin doesn't have to show. The arm tefillin doesn't have to show. Put it under your sleeve. It's something for you. Whereas the head tefillin should show. The head tefillin should show. Okay. Now, in the next... Into the next paragraph, verse 16, on page 364, it says, shall be a sign for you on your hand and totafos, between your eyes. Whatever totafos are. I'll teach you something very important here. Does Rashi bring this? Yeah. Listen to Rashi's words. Totafos peninecha, because there are four compartments in the head, unlike the arm. The arm is one compartment, and all four paragraphs are written on one piece of parchment and it's rolled up. In the head, you have four compartments, and there are four separate pieces of parchment. That's why they're called totafos. Tat, in the Kafti language, is two. Pat, in African language, is two. Now, naive, simplistic academics, that might be redundant, say, you see here that even Rashi recognizes that the Torah took words from other languages. Because Rashi is saying that tat in kafti is one, and pat is in Afriki is another. You see that the Torah took words from other languages. It's not correct. The Shlach Kodesh already says, can't expect the academics to know the Shlach Kodesh, but the Shlach Kodesh says, that it's the other way around. There were words in Hebrew that dropped out of usage in Hebrew and found their way into other languages and were preserved in other languages. That's why when Rashi will say that this is a word in Persian or this is a word in Greek, he's not saying that the Torah borrowed a Persian word. That's absurd. Rashi would be the last person in the world to say it. But rather, this is a Hebrew word whose meaning is lost in our literature. Never used again. No associated words. And since you see that that's what it means in those other languages, you say that it was taken from Hebrew. Whether this goes back to the Migdal Bovel, to the Tower of Babel, or not. By the way, having mentioned that, let me fill you in on another interesting and important fact. The Tower of Babel says that the whole earth spoke one language. Safa Achas, Vedvorim Achadim, spoke one language. Then, because of building the tower, God confused their language. So we naturally think, up until then there was one language, and then that language disappeared, and it was replaced by lots and lots of other limited languages. The Torah Tmima brings the Yerushalmi, which says that wasn't the process at all. The truth was that every nation had its own language before the Tower of Babel. But in addition to each nation having its own language, there was a single international language that everybody spoke. Like today, English. English is an international language. If you're lost anywhere in the world, you speak English, and one out of five people will know how to answer you. In the 2,000 years ago, it was Greek. Everybody in this area of the world spoke Greek, in addition to their private languages. Hebrew was the one international language, and then there were the local languages. What happened to the Tower of Babel is that God caused everyone to forget Hebrew, or everyone except those from whom we came, to forget Hebrew. Now, since everybody spoke the international language, nobody bothered working out a translation scheme from this local dialect to that local dialect. It wasn't necessary. When you talked to a person from another place, you used the international language. So therefore, when they forgot the international language, they were stuck. They couldn't talk to one another. And there's another source. I thought this was in the Torah Tmima. I looked it up a couple of years ago. I can't find it anymore, but I found it when I was going through the sources. That says that these separate languages even go back before the flood, and Noah took samples of these languages with him on the Teva, so that after the flood they'd be able to recreate those other languages. So when archaeologists tell you that they have samples of many languages in the world prior to the time of the flood, don't faint, don't get upset, don't be worried. Our sources allow for that very reality.
Why would Noah do that?
Good question, why I would do that. But that's what the sources say. You know, if you want to bring an objection to a position, you have to pay attention to what the position says. The position says that he had them and he preserved them and recreated them. Okay, back to work. Notice in this verse when it says, 16, when it says, should be a sign on your hand, it says, Yod Cha with a Hey. Yod Dalet Chaf Hey. That's an extremely rare spelling. It may not occur anywhere else in the entire Tanakh. A possessive, meaning yours, chaf and a hey. Here's where Chazal learned a very important halacha of tefillin. Which arm does a tefillin go on?
Your weaker arm.
Right, not the left arm. Goes on your weaker arm. If you're a lefty, it goes on your right arm. This is where it's learned from. Kaf hey is can be understood as kehe. Kehe means like pale, faded, not full strength. And that being the case, it has to go on the weaker arm. Now the question is, what does that communicate? The verse ends, for with a strong hand I took you out of Egypt. This is the one that says it goes on the weaker arm, and the verse ends, for with a strong hand I took you out of Egypt. I don't know if you bother to do this, but in the Siddur you have a paragraph that's printed before you put on tefillin, a sort of meditation, coming from Kabbalistic sources. What do the tefillin symbolize? Now, you could have said, this isn't what's written in the Siddur, it is written by one of the authorities, but it's not written in the Siddur, it comes from a different tradition. You could have said, the tefillin symbolize, this is close to the Rashbam now, dedicating everything to God. Of course, it's leather boxes, but when you put it on your arm, that symbolizes dedicating your actions to God. It's connected to your heart. That symbolizes your emotions, your will to God. On your head, your mind, everything is dedicated to God. You could have said that. It would have been a single idea carried out in all three. It would have been very easy to understand. That's not what it says. What it says is it's on your head to dedicate your mind to God. It's on your heart to dedicate your feelings and your will to God. And it's on your arm to remember the outstretched arm with which God took us out of Egypt. It breaks the symbolism. It isn't three of a kind. It's two of one kind and one of another kind. Well, that needs some kind of explanation. Why not? Especially since it's so easy to make it consistent. Mind, emotions, will, and action. It's just, you know, it sort of jumps right out at you when you see it. And yet, the Kabbalistic tradition broke it. The answer is what I've told you in the first paragraph, last time, and today we mentioned it briefly. When a human being performs an action, any action, when a person does something, what's going on? The whole of the physical world is God's production. God makes everything happen. So when a human being performs an action, what really happens is this. The human being makes a decision. That decision is an event in his soul. And God manipulates the world, or better said, creates the world so that the decision, the soul, is carried out. Which means every action is really a partnership. It's a partnership. If you want to know how God interacts with you, if you want to feel God relating to you, every time you raise your arm, you have to recognize you decided and God created your body with the arm going up. That being the case, you have to know that in everything that happens in the world, you have the weaker share. You have the weaker share. God has the stronger share. That's why you put it on the weaker arm. You put it on your weaker arm to remember that God's strong arm is what took you out of Egypt. So it carries out that symbolism even in the way that Phil and I are situated. And that would be fitting for a Kabbalistic perspective where you look at what philosophers would call the metaphysics, how things really work in the ruchnis, in the spiritual reality. Okay? Okay, yeah. Now we're going to start B'Shalach. It happened when Paro sent the people. God did not lead them, etc., etc. These words contain the seeds of a tragedy. These words contain the seeds of a tragedy. Or Chaim asks, Chazal tell us that Vayehi is usually a language that expresses pain. Vahoyah expresses joy, and Vayehi expresses pain. Ask the Or Chaim, why would there be an expression of pain? They're leaving Egypt. This was the point of the whole exercise. Now it's finally coming to fruition. Where is the pain here? An answer is that Pharaoh sent them out. They didn't leave on their own. The Exodus wasn't their performance, it was his performance. He pushed them out. And therefore he still had a connection to them. They didn't make a clean break. Had it been the moment that Pharaoh said, "You're free, I don't want you here anymore," the Jews had picked up and run, it would have been entirely different. But that's not what happened. That's not what happened. We read this a few days ago. It says, when they finally came to the first resting place, they made matzahs. Why did they make matzahs? They're free men. What are they, free people? What are they eating matzah for? Because they took out of Egypt, they didn't have a chance to let it rise. They didn't have a chance to let it rise because they couldn't tarry. They couldn't tarry. Ki gorshu Mitzrayim, because they were expelled from Egypt. If you tell me they couldn't tarry, what are you telling me? That if they could have, they would have. They weren't in such a hurry. They had other things to do. You know, okay, we have permission at midnight. Let's go. We'll leave at 4 a.m. Well, we have lots of time. You know, Pharaoh's beaten and he's given up. We have some things to prepare. No. The Egyptians pushed them, threw them out. Because they were scared to death. Good, but that means that they didn't pick up and run. They didn't make the break. They were pushed out. And because Pharaoh pushed them out, he still has a connection with them. Pharaoh's engineering the Exodus. And that, according to some, is why there has to be a replay. There has to be a replay. Where's the replay? At the Yam Suf, at the sea. God leads them out. They says, no, don't go that way. Go back and camp next to the sea. next to the sea means you got mountains on the right, mountains on the left, in front of you is the sea, and behind you is coming the Egyptian army. Why? Why are we going through that? Because the break with Egypt hasn't taken place yet. The real break with Egypt hasn't taken place yet. So it has to be done all over again. So as to make the break absolute. So that's what the Torah is telling you here. Pharaoh sent them out. And therefore he still has a connection. Now, I'm generalizing on something that Rebbe told me, we'll get to it in Yetzer Hashem eventually, that when you look at the processes that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up here, nothing happens perfectly. Nothing happens perfectly. God sort of lays out a tachnit, a schedule for things to happen. There's always some kind of failure, always some kind of lack. And then those failures lead to later failures. They pile up.
It's not a lack on Hashem's part, obviously.
No, it's not a lack on Hashem's part. Hashem set up a process, and we failed to carry it out perfectly. And because we failed to carry it out, there are always chinks in the armor. The opportunities to overcome, and we're working uphill because of a failure. You can trace them back, and there are these problems going all the way back. Okay? And this is the key to this one here. Okay, we'll pick up here tomorrow in the session.
Sure. Perfect.